Nothing on.
Ah, there we go. Lovely. Groovy. Okay, are we ready?
I think we are.
Are you ready, Nick?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, if you just talk nice and close into that mic, because I think that's a little bit... Right, I've got Nick Brumfield here. Hello, Nick. Nice to see you again. I'm going to let you into a little secret. I can't hear Nick, actually, in my headphones, should I?
You should be able to.
His microphone's not... His fader's not up, that's why. There we go.
Why.
There we go. Let's try now.
Okay, can you hear me now?
This man's a sound recordist, Davis. You know how bad this is.
An apology for a sound recording.
Okay, Nick, you're here. Listen, we've met a couple of times before.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I need to let you into a secret.
Yeah.
First time was about 10 years ago on the 11 o'clock show. Hadn't seen any of your films. And the second time was a couple of years ago on it was Loose Ends, I think, on Radio 4 with Ned Sheeran. And I hadn't seen many of your films then. And I was a little bit. Since then, I've seen nearly all of your films. And I've realised what a fantastic filmmaker you are. So this is why I've got you in.
What a wonderful occasion. I love hearing this.
It is.
It's normally something very different. How could you do that?
It's all good. And I tell you what I remember seeing... I'm going to get some of the titles wrong, so excuse me. His Big White Self, His Great White Self.
His
Big White Self. Yeah. That was, I think, the first one I saw. And then about a year ago, Moore 4 showed Ghosts...
Right.
About the Chinese cockle pickers.
Yeah.
And it, if I'm honest, it had me in tears, man. It's one of the saddest, it's a very tragic film in the true sense of the word, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why did you go, you've been asked this a million times, from documentary to feature films?
Well, I mean, just on a sort of very personal level, I think filmmaking for me has always been about discovering things you didn't think you could do right from the beginning. You know, I mean, without being really boring. I was like hopeless at school. And the first thing I was ever any good at was taking stills. And then I thought, oh, there's actually something I can do. And then making films for me was like, you know, first of all, I did sort of quite traditional documentaries. Then I sort of put myself in them and had a bit of a laugh with it, you know, monkeyed around with it. And then I sort of thought, well, actually, I know how to do this. The films all became a bit like, okay, I know how to make this film. And then I thought, well, it's time to move on and try and do something completely different.
Yeah.
So I wanted to sort of take what I'd learned in documentary to making a feature film. So I worked with, like, real Chinese illegal immigrants. You know, they'd all been in the back of trucks and
stuff. Oh, had they really? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and I kind of recreated an environment in which they had lived. I sort of got this house in Thetford.
Mm.
They all lived together in the house, in slightly better conditions than they would have done as illegal immigrants, but pretty bad. And they sort of bonded and formed this group. And it was very much modeled on their experiences.
Mm.
So I was learning from them in the same way that you would do in a documentary. And also, it brought all their emotions back to being away from their families in China. I mean, I Ching, who was the lead in Ghosts, her son was back in China. So every time we talked about her son, she just started bawling, you know, and was like... So it was a very moving experience making the film, and I think that's really what probably comes across.
It does come... She was fantastic in it as well. She was superb.
Well, she was just like a waitress in a Chinese restaurant. She had never acted before.
How long did that whole filming process of that take?
I think it probably took about 3 months of shooting.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it is just the sad... I mean, it's I guess it's sadder because it's based on a true story as well, but it's just horrific what they go through, the abuse, and then obviously, you know, that bit where they're stuck on the top of the minibus at the end. It's just horrible.
I think people in this country have no idea what, you know, undocumented workers or illegal workers go through. You know, most of us go into a Chinese restaurant and just sort of, you know, have a bit of spare ribs sort of thing. But the conditions that the people live in fact, it was just down the road here. I went sort of undercover at the beginning of the film and went down to Gerrard Street, and you pay someone 200 quid. They introduce you to a gangmaster. I went up to Birmingham.
Really?
Yeah. You know, just to sort of learn how it all operated.
Yeah.
And I was staying in this house. In fact, with I Ching, I went with I Ching. I was pretending to be South African because you get South African whites who haven't got any work.
Yeah.
And,
did you do a good South African accent? Did you have to?
I was hopeless.
Right, okay.
The Chinese don't really know one South African accent from another. That was my advantage there. But there were like 12 to a room, and you know we'd get up at like 4 in the morning. You'd be working till 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and you'll get piecework. I was terrible at it. I was mainly picking spring onions and stuff.
And you actually did this?
I did this, yeah.
Jeez.
And the spring onions were going to Tesco, Sainsbury's and, you know...
Were they really?
Big supermarkets.
See, now that's a revelation, that those big supermarkets have...
Well, they all pretend they don't know.
Yeah.
And the law is such that enables the supermarkets to say, oh, we didn't know.
Yeah.
We went to, you know, it's just the farmer's fault.
Yeah.
The farmer will say, oh, it's the employment agency's fault. And, you know, so no one really deals with it. And some little gangmaster who's the most irrelevant cog in the machine then gets banged up in court for it. And it just continues on. Because I guess it all happened after Thatcher. She kind of made casual labour the thing and she deregulated everything.
Mm.
So all the sort of trade union safety regulations went.
Yeah.
It enabled all these people to be basically treated as sort of modern-day slaves.
You going off on a slight tangent, you mentioned your South African accent. Mm. There's a great scene where you meet Terre Blanche again, goes jumping through time a little bit.
Yeah.
You meet him for the second time, 10 years after, or whatever it is, after you've made the first film. And you do the worst posh... accent I've ever heard in my life. It's terrible.
I think I'm terrible at accents.
You are.
I'm a terrible actor, really.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely terrible. Otherwise, I would have done something much more interesting. It's probably actually why I had to end up making sort of semi-fiction films, because otherwise one could have pushed it into a sort of Borat-type mode, which is much more amusing. Because ultimately, you've got to be interested in what you're doing. But if I could have acted a bit better, then I could have... Also, the other... I've cut them out of the scene... out of the film, but I dressed up as a sort of Indian and tried to join like these tennis clubs and stuff in Ventersdorp. But my Indian accent was even worse than my posh accent. So, you know, everyone said, please cut that out of the film.
It's oh, no.
So horribly
Release
embarrassing.
That. This is what you want. You want a box set of all the outtakes and the stuff that was just too bad.
Yeah.
You must have...
Well, there's a big box of that.
You must have balls of steel, though, because you put yourself... in, you're talking about pretending to be a South African illegal immigrant. You put yourself in terrifying situations making these films. The one, let me point out the one that, when I was watching it, and I was saying before this that it's the last 6 months, it's been Nick Broomfield season in my house. Me and my girlfriend have, you got a spare evening? Let's put a Broomfield on. We've been loving it.
How
but
funny.
It's fantastic. We're having a great time. We're having a great time. Say, as I said, apart from last night, Soldier Girls, a man biting a head off a live chicken. That's bad. But
you know, that's what it's like in the army, because they're all mad. Because I always
they are all mad. Yes,
they're completely mad. You know, and they would eat bugs and
yeah.
And I actually found them to be a hilarious bunch of guys.
But
you'd sort of think they're all quite normal. And then they suddenly do things like that. They try and shock people constantly.
But then you met them again in the extras at the end, 15 years, 20 years after. And it was the gentleman and the lady's name just came. And they were quite normal, with kids and families and...
Well, yeah, but they're completely bonkers underneath it.
Really, are they still bonkers?
Yeah.
But the thing I was thinking was Kurt and Courtney... You're hunting down Courtney Love, and she's been very rude and very distant and not talking to you. And there's the awards ceremony where you get up on stage.
Yeah.
Can you talk me through that? Because that was just...
Well, it was the American Council of Civil Liberties, which is all to do with sort of freedom of speech and all the rest of freedom of the press.
Yeah.
And Courtney is famous for having beaten up journalists who didn't write good articles about her and so on. And she was presenting the prize, or she received a prize, the Torture Freedom Award. And I thought, this is ridiculous. Here's somebody who beats up journalists, who's presenting the Torture Freedom Award. You know, Hollywood is completely mad just because she's got a bit of celebrity.
Yeah.
Why don't you think about what she actually represents? So I was desperate for an end to the film anyway. I've been going on that film for like, you know, 12, 14 weeks.
Yeah.
I had a budget for 5, so I was kind of couldn't really pay my crew anymore. And I thought, this is a way of finishing the film. I can get up, I can... confront Courtney, I can obviously humiliate myself completely.
That's a fantastic humiliation, so well done.
I thought it was terrible. And I was completely shitting myself, but my girlfriend said, if you don't get up on stage, I'm going to do it. You know, so I was kind of pushed up to doing it.
So you just walked up on stage in the middle of this award ceremony and stood behind the lectern.
Yeah. And said,
started a rant.
I can't understand why you've got Courtney Love to present the award. And I remember the next day I was speaking to my agent, who was a big agent at CAA. And then he said, did you hear about what happened at this awards ceremony last night? And I said, yeah, Dan, I was going to tell you, it was me. He said, no! He sort of threw the phone up in the air and I could just hear him screaming in the office. He said, you'll never get any work now, you know. And of course, you know, it took like 6 months for the film to come out before anyone realised that I hadn't completely lost my mind.
But you do that. And again, Terre Blanche, we watched both of those films quite recently. This is why he's fresh in my mind. And there's that horrible thing. What's brilliant about those films is that he's a very nasty man, it seems. And it's a very serious issue, you know, apartheid and racism and violent racism. But it's still, you still make it quite funny. Like when you keep going for the meetings and he's not there. He's arranged to meet you and he's not there and you kind of like shrug your shoulders and walk out. But then when you finally do get the meeting and you keep him waiting for 10, 15 minutes and he goes mental. And did you say something like, oh, we had a cup of tea or something ridiculous and flippant?
He was an awful bully.
Yeah.
He was a bit like sort of Margaret Thatcher. You know, bullies have no self-humour at all. So they're enormously funny to tease because they don't react at all well. You know, it's like with Terre Blanche, it would be just annoy him a bit and he would go ballistic. He'd go out of control.
Yeah.
He'd have no, you know, another time we had a big truck, you know, when we were doing the filming and they didn't have trucks. So we said, oh, we'll carry the drums for you to the next big rally. And so we got to the rally and we were deliberately about 20 minutes late, which meant the whole rally had to be delayed 20 minutes because they needed the drum to get everyone to walk.
And this is a rally for a far right,
there were
racist organization.
15,000 people. So when we finally got there with the drum kit, he wanted to skin us alive. You know, and we got one of our best scenes there, you know, where he just goes absolutely crazy.
Is that the one where he's bollocking you and he says, your cameraman is a monkey?
Yeah, exactly. And you see the real man.
So
it's a question of provoking them to that point where the real person comes through all the bullshit.
But you're still taking the mic then, because you've got your back to him a little bit. He's saying, your cameraman is a bloody monkey. And you're turning to the camera going, yeah, he is, and sort of doing a little wink, sly wink.
Well, yeah, because it was funny. Actually, we nearly all got beaten up in that.
Oh, yeah, that's funny, yeah. It looks terrifying.
That was a bit terrifying. But we'd all become very good friends with his heads of security, because they all used to have, you know, schnapps and stuff at the driver's house next door. So we used to camp out in the driver's house, who was a great guy, actually, called JP.
Yes.
And so we knew them all, and they actually protected us. You know, so you've got to know how far you can go, because you don't really want to end up, obviously, badly beaten up.
Have you ever been beaten up?
I haven't, miraculously.
No, that surprises me.
Some pretty close calls.
Because you push it, and you push it, and you push it, and no one's even gone for a raised hand or anything.
Well, the drum kit, no, there were some raised hands
there. Okay.
And then the head of security sort of protected us. Yeah. Like, these guys are all right, leave them alone.
You know?
So escorted us out of there. But that was pretty close. And the cameraman, Barry Aykroyd, who actually shot the last Paul Greengrass film.
Okay.
He got punched and knocked out at the beginning of the film.
Wow.
Yeah, but I escaped that one.
Well done.
I think they generally tend to go for the camera.
Yeah.
Which is probably why I've always done sound, because I'm really quite a coward.
One question I want to ask you, because when I did the 11 o'clock show, we did lots of secret filming and lots of stuff on the fly where you turn up and doorstep people and stuff like that. How do you get... Do you have to get everyone to sign a release form? And I'm thinking of two scenes in particular in Curt and Courtney. The one where you walk into the wrong apartment, you open the door, wrong apartment, sorry, and walk out again, which is just wonderful. And the scene where you walk into... I can't remember what building it is, but you walk into the reception and you ask for someone, and the woman says, you can't film here. Okay, we'll go. No, you stay here, wait for security. And then an alarm goes off, and she keeps saying, no, you stay here. And you go, no, we're off now, we're going. Did you have to get her to sign a release form, or is there some rule that says you're allowed to show? How does that work?
Well, I think, you know, the rules actually vary. I mean, I think in America especially, if you're a public, regarded as a public person, in other words, if you're a person who's benefited from being well-known, then you're open to being filmed.
Okay.
You know, you're regarded as a public figure.
But a lady on reception, though?
A lady on reception, I think, is just regarded as somebody who is in a public place.
Oh, right, okay.
You know, and so they have a public function, and they are the kind of people who are likely to be filmed.
And so you're allowed to get them, that's fine. Because over here...
I think it would be different if you were asserting that she was also a serial rapist or something.
Yes, of course, which we're, of course, not asserting that at all. Over here, it's different, I think. Unless you're doing a public service, I think is the term, you're allowed... Otherwise, you have to get them to sign or get permission on camera or stuff like that.
I suppose the other thing too is that if people know that they're being filmed,
yeah,
they're not being secretly filmed, and they don't actually say stop filming,
mm,
then that is
okay,
considered to be consent.
Yeah. When did you start appearing in your films?
I think out of complete desperation. I sort of did. I was working on a film in New York, and it was going really badly.
Is this the Lily Tomlin one?
Well, no, the Lily Tomlin film had gone really badly.
Right.
And the real film actually was never really shot.
Right.
The real film being mainly Lily Tomlin screaming at us, saying,
yeah,
you know, I kind of hate you and I don't want you around. And
fantastic.
You know, being completely uncooperative. And, of course, what we ended up with was a very sort of polite film, which she hated anyway and sued us in any event.
Oh,
so
really?
I thought, yeah. So I thought, we've really missed out on all the fun.
Mm.
You know, we've got all these great stories about what a dreadful bitch she was, but we haven't got anything on film.
Mm.
And I thought that really can't... You know, if you're making a documentary, you want to have the real thing. You don't want to have a sort of an apology.
Yeah, of course.
But, so when I was starting on the very next film and things started going really wrong from the beginning, I said, look, I really want to film the whole thing. I don't want to just film this show that we're supposed to be doing. I want to film all the fights between the financiers and the producer and the fights between the choreographers and, you know, and I want to be able to make what's actually happening. I don't want to just, you know, and there was a bit of resistance, but in the end they agreed to it. So it was a sort of experiment.
Mm.
And of course I was in it too, because they tend to get very annoyed with the director all the time,
yeah,
because you're a convenient thing to blame. So it was an experiment and it kind of worked. I mean, it was sort of, it was a bit like being able to film the bubble in your head.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, when you're having a conversation with someone, you're thinking something completely different. And it was incredibly liberating because traditional documentary is quite pure in a way.
Mm.
And you have to get the beginning, middle, and end of scenes for it to make any sense.
Mm.
Whereas this thing, which is very subjective and it's with your own thought track, you can, it's very impressionistic and you can jump all over the place.
Mm.
So it was very liberating, and I really enjoyed it, and it was very amusing to me to make those films. You know, I loved making those films.
And there is a big difference in the films, because so I watched Soldier Girls last night, and you pop up
Soldier
in for a
Girls
second,
is
actually.
Soldier Girls is a very pure film,
yeah,
movie, and it was great to make.
And there's no commentary, you don't even hear you interviewing people, it's like you're just there with a camera and you're just recording,
yeah,
what's happening.
It's much more the sort of fly on the wall.
Yeah.
And you build up characters and you follow the characters through.
Mm.
And it's a very hard kind of filming to do.
Mm.
And it's very much, you know, like Fred Wiseman and Kim Longinotto makes those films brilliantly now. Molly Deneen, those. But I always, then if you take more complicated stories that don't kind of follow a process, like Soldier Girls is basic training, really.
Yeah.
So it's 7.2 weeks. You've got a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
Or if you do a film about the police, you've got an institution. But if you do something like Kurt and Courtney, or you do something like Biggie and Tupac, which is an investigation, it's much more arbitrary where you go. And things don't go right. And then you've got someone like Courtney, who's determined the film doesn't happen.
Mm.
And she starts kiboshing all your funding. So you're losing all your funders, and then detectives are investigating you, and you're getting threatening phone calls. And
I'm smiling, but it sounds awful. You
everything's
know, it's terrible.
Going wrong. And then you think... I mean, I always think once you start a film, you finish it, no matter what. And if someone does terrible things to you, you put that all in the film because it's all part of the film. So with Courtney, you know, we just built it more and more. The more dreadful things she did, that was what went into the film.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of also a very interesting way of making a film.
But am I right in thinking now that in the documentary since then, that quite often to get the funding, they would say, yeah, but you've got to be in it now. You have to pop up with your green puffer jacket
exactly,
and your boom.
And all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And then it became less interesting. Because at the beginning when I started doing it, they'd sort of say to my producer, see if you can keep him behind the camera. You know. And then, of course, you know, it's great fun to go, I'm here, I'm you know, sort of, you know, doing everything to...
Yeah.
And then when they say, yeah, you've got to be in front of the camera, you think, actually, this is kind of like boring.
Yeah, yeah, when you're being told.
It would have been more fun, obviously, if you could, you know, be as brilliant as sort of Borat or you know, and you could be, you know, a gay hairdresser in the next one or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid I had
Nick Brunfeld is a gay hairdresser.
My abilities in that direction.
One of my favourite bits of you kind of popping up is Fetishes, which I think is probably my favourite film.
Really? And,
I love it. I love it. It's
some
just
people hate that one.
Do they really?
Yeah.
Oh, we love it. We thought it was wonderful. And
it is funny.
There's two fantastic. I don't know if you've seen it there. There's two fantastic scenes. The first one, I think it's a guy in like a gimp mask and he's chained up and he's being whipped. And it goes on for about 90 seconds, 2 minutes, just this guy being whipped. And off camera, you hear this voice going, so when did you realise you were into being whipped? And it's brilliant. You've been there watching it and we forget that you're watching it. But you start interviewing this guy. I think it's a guy.
Yeah.
And you start interviewing him.
Yeah.
And the other great one is the guy who's being made to lick the toilet clean. He's been made, this is his sexual perversion.
And then they flush his head down.
They
the
flush
toilet.
His head and they put the seat on it. So his head's in the toilet. And you go into the cameraman or woman, should I ask him a question? Should I talk to him? And it's just what you start interviewing him with his head down the toilet.
That was one of those great moments of
it's
cinema,
wonderful.
Wasn't it?
How long were you that was obviously in a brothel in New York, was
it?
I think
in New York.
How long were you hanging out there and did they get you in the end? Because they were trying to
A couple of months. Yeah, well, they were determined. I think there's a big clash between directors, film directors, and dominatrixes, really.
Right.
Because they both want to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
So Mistress Raven, who ran the place, was determined, actually, that I was going to make the kind of film she wanted.
Of course.
A puff piece. And I was determined to do something very different. So she was dying to give me a session. And I knew she would tie me up and just beat me black and blue.
It would have been a nasty one as well. I'm sure you had
really
the ability
nasty.
To be nasty.
And there was normally, you could call, there was, they had what they call a safe word.
Yeah.
You say something like red, and then they stop beating you. But I knew I could scream red all I wanted
and
to.
And there would be no
she
guess
would just
out.
Carry on Jeez. Until I was, yeah. So I was very determined not to have the session with Mistress Raven. And of course, I think some people were very disappointed that I didn't, of course, get beaten up on film, because they'd always wanted that
to happen. There's, you know, pushing yourself, your art, and then there's taking it to the next level. There's no need to that. There is that scene where you're being chased around by about seven prostitutes at one point, and they're all trying to get a piece of you, and it's wonderful, you know. There's also that weird scene, the wrestling scene, with that guy who wants
the
to...
The guy goes crazy.
Yeah.
They start fighting.
And it gets really... That's really uncomfortable, really nasty. This guy wants to wrestle the woman. This is his thing. But he wants to have like a real full-on nasty wrestle, and she's kind of wrestling, but it's more of a play thing.
Yeah, it's to do with the woman, you know, being the dominatrix.
Yeah.
And he's supposed to be
he wants to win, doesn't he?
He wanted to beat her up.
And he suddenly just storms up and goes, I'm not doing this, I'm out. You're taking... And he just... the weirdest.
Yeah, it was kind of...
Were they all right... The clients, were they all right about you filming them? Was there any coercion or did you have to pay them?
Well, occasionally people went a little crazy.
Yeah.
You know, because it's... I think sometimes you're hitting people's emotions quite hard.
Yeah.
And I remember, I mean, occasionally there were accidents where we'd go into the wrong room. And, you know,
Fantastic.
Some guys, you know, I remember there was one guy he was being strung up to the ceiling and he had an apple or a ball or something in his mouth. And we walked in there by mistake and he couldn't actually say anything because he had this thing in his mouth. But his eyes almost came out of his head, you know. And we kind of left there. And then there was somebody else who was going through what they call a concentration camp scenario.
Oh, yes, yes.
And part of this very peculiar scenario involved somebody having his penis guillotined in a sort of pretend guillotine. And we were filming this, and it was rather extreme. And
yes.
The guy suddenly
rather extreme. That's an understatement, isn't it?
The guy flipped out, completely flipped out, went into a kind of, you know, weird... He just sort of became another person.
Yeah.
Suddenly, although he had agreed to us being in there and filming him, he regressed into something else. And it became apparent that he was kind of having a weird kind of attack.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes it was, you know, people... I think some of the people were quite extreme who were in there, you know. And you were playing, you know, playing a bit with fire, I think.
Yeah. Okay, we're running out of time. Let's move on very quickly. Battle for Haditha. It's Haditha, isn't it? It's another fantastic feature film, I guess you'd call it. And I noticed watching Soldier Girls last night, a few similarities.
Yeah.
In the, there's a scene in Soldier Girls where, I think, is it Private Hall? I can't remember her name. Is comforting another one, saying, we'll get through this. We'll get through this together.
Yeah.
And it just, it felt very reminiscent of Haditha, that kind of camaraderie. And
yeah, I actually thought of that a lot when I was shooting Haditha. Because Haditha, which we shot in Jordan, which is about Iraq, we had ex-Marines who had been in Iraq in it.
Right.
All those guys were Marines.
Again, they're fantastic actors, man. You know, it's incredible.
They were fantastic, yeah. None of them had acted before.
Yeah.
And it felt very real. And I think by being all together in the barracks, they all felt like they were back in Iraq.
Right.
In fact, some of them got quite sort of paranoid.
Right.
They all thought they were going to be shot all the time. And furthermore, I wanted to get them shot. But I think their performances were amazing. And you really believed that they were Marines. You could tell it wasn't some Hollywood pufter who is pretending to be...
Is that the technical term for them, is it? The Hollywood pufter? That's the technical phrase.
Well, you know those camp performances
thing. Yes.
You get out of Hollywood.
Those big macho...
And you could tell they've never been anywhere near anything kind of, you know, other than in a sort of four-star hotel bed.
Yeah.
You know. So, these were the real thing, and there were Iraqis who were in that film too, most of whom were refugees who had lost family members and stuff. So the emotions were all right on the surface, and it was a really powerful film to
watch. It's an incredible film to watch. Again, it's sort of very beautiful, if that's in the setting, but it's also incredibly ugly in what happens and people's attitudes to war. And there's kind of a and maybe I misunderstood it, but there's sort of a big question mark over exactly who are the bad people and who are the good people, and it's all a... It seems very confusing.
It's all about the fog of war, really.
Yeah.
It's like, I guess once you go to war, the rights and wrongs all go.
Yeah.
It's all survival, and it's all like paranoid reaction.
Yeah, very much so.
Everyone's operating on the sort of worst case scenario kind of thing, and everyone distrusts each other, and it becomes impossible to really decide who's right and who's wrong. I mean, they've all got their own points of view.
Was it easy to get that film shown? I'd imagine there'd be resistance to that film.
It was very resistant in America.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it did very well in Europe and in this country. But in America, I mean, when it first opened in the American Cinematheque, I was sort of standing on stage afterwards for a Q&A. And I didn't have to say a word.
Really?
Because the audience got into such a fight with each other.
Fantastic.
I mean, there was a couple who stood up at the end of the film and just screamed at me for making this anti-American film. And all that. Then other people got up and screamed at them, saying, how can you say this? You're being completely ridiculous. And in the end, the film manager, the theatre manager, had to say, like, shut up, the lot of you. This is like a pub brawl.
I don't think it is necessarily an anti-American film, is it? I would say it's
I think Americans who are very sensitive about, you know, particularly under the Bush administration, I think they became very sensitive about the fact that the rest of the world hated them.
Yeah.
And overly sensitive to the point that they couldn't really look at themselves.
Yeah, of course.
And very defensive about what they were doing in Iraq and so on. And I think that's changing now a bit.
Yeah.
But I think there was a long period of time that anybody who was critical of what was happening in Iraq, in America, was regarded as completely unpatriotic.
Mm, of course.
There was a kind of McCarthyite feel in America. It was, you know, and I think we're coming out of that now. But it's, you know, but I think, you know, outside of New York and Los Angeles, you're still...
Yes.
You know.
The slightly artsier places that we'll get something like that. What's... is there a project on the go now that you're working on?
I'm doing a script based on a Ronan Bennett book called The Catastrophist, which is a love story set in the Congo in the 1960s at the time when, you know, Lumumba came to power.
Already, and I love it.
Yeah, it's a great novel.
And how far have you got with that? You're working on the script, or is...
Yeah, I'm working on the script. I've got to sort of hand it in at the end of this month.
Wow, like a school project.
Yeah, it is. Like, well, you
could
say
try
that
harder,
to yourself,
Brumfield.
You say that to yourself so that you don't go mental.
Yeah,
you know, so you're not writing it like in 2 years' time.
You're a deadline person. Yes, I'm the same. I need to have a date, and I'll have it done by then.
You know, so I keep my sanity.
So is it features from now on? Is there are we ever going to see the return of the green puffer jacket
actually,
and the boom?
Funnily enough, one of my distributors is on the verge of bankruptcy and owes me a great deal of money. So I put my bomber jacket on and headphones and everything. And I went there yesterday to squat in their offices with
really?
A camera until I got paid.
Fantastic.
It's actually on Kurt and Courtney. And I was going to say, unfortunately, they had already had their offices padlocked up. So, but I got there And I thought, this is rather fun, actually. I must do another of these films.
Oh, yes, yeah. Please do.
And I brought a suitcase with, you know, bedding in it. And,
yeah.
And just to convince them I was going to camp in the offices until I got paid. But, yeah, I thought, this is great fun. I have to do another film.
Yeah. Oh, you must do. And, you know, not to detract, you know, that your features are fantastic and they are wonderful. But, it, you know, you've got
to do... Those are great fun to do.
Yeah.
The ones.
Yeah. You must do one more for us, please.
I will.
That's a guarantee. Hey, Nick, it's lovely to see you again. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Brilliant, man. Thank you so much.
Good.